Okay, hi. Thank you very much. Thank you to the organizers, and it's an honor to be here. I'm Ben Golub. I just want to start by saying a few quick words about Emmanuel and then move on to the talk. So I, of course, always admired Emmanuel, mostly from afar at first, and then when he got interested in production networks, it was this great gift to see all of his famous qualities, his curiosity, his insight, his intensity, up close, working in this area that some of us were working in. And in addition to everything else that he brought, I think this incredible inspiration that came from knowing that Emmanuel Farhi, at the peak of his powers, chose to devote some of his time to these issues, and he thought they were important. That inspiration survives him. I was mostly too shy to take advantage of that generosity that Ali Reza mentioned. But I remember the few serious conversations, maybe three or four conversations that we had about the work that I'm about to talk about in this area, were these big pivotal moments in my life intellectually, and I treasure them, and I remember a lot of them, a lot of parts of those conversations, word for word. So I join everyone in mourning and missing the incredible force that Emmanuel Farhi was. And with that, I will talk about supply network formation and fragility, which is very much inspired by his work on production networks. So a paper is about the robustness of a complex supply network. And so what we want to think about in this model is a process of complex production where we have many steps occurring to produce something, and each of those steps involves putting together multiple essential inputs. So another important feature that will run through the whole project is that sourcing is customized, very much like in Ali Reza's talk. And so firms here are not going to rely on some kind of generic commodity inputs that they can go out and buy. They need specific sourcing from suppliers that know how to make exactly what they need. And often that involves implicitly shipping and delivery times and things like that. And so I have a toy little example here. Imagine that you have an airplane manufacturer that's sourced everything they need to make an airplane except for brakes and computers. And they're going to have sourcing options to get those from the brake and computer industry, but particular firms in those industries. And then the brake, let's say focus on one of the brake guys, they're going to be similar sourcing other inputs, maybe we can call them disks and computers, to produce their particular complex good. And this will continue for a while, maybe eventually it'll stop. And it looks like that all throughout the supply network. And so the whole project is built around this idea that firms are reliant on specific firms delivering rather than generic inputs. And there's a lot of great evidence accumulating for that in the literature, of which I've given only a small sampling. So because these supply relationships won't always work as intended, they might fail or be at least delayed. So this whole model will be on some time scale, maybe think of a month or a quarter. And so sometimes these links won't be delivering what you hope they will. And because of that, which is you already see in the picture, there's multi-sourcing, which means firms maintain either multiple actual suppliers of inputs, which some firms do, or at least multiple sourcing opportunities, meaning multiple firms they could call on the phone and say, hey, I can't get my iPhone screens, you know, can you make me some now? So there's going to be this network of sourcing possibilities which will somehow be used to produce. And so the questions that we're going to focus on are, the basic question is just how robust is the network to shocks, aggregate shocks, that are going to affect the probabilities of all these links working with some common element. So there's going to be a common shock that's going to hit the whole economy. And a leading example, we can talk about others, but one important example is shipping congestion that's affected the whole world network of logistics. And so, you know, there's a mechanical question of what is that going to do? What is a shock like that that maybe slightly affects the probabilities of all these links working? What is that going to do to the whole system mechanically? And then if we step back and ask that, you know, about these, if we think about these links as endogenous things that firms invest in to make them work, is investment in robustness going to be efficient? And so our main finding is going to be a fragile regime where aggregate output is arbitrarily sensitive to small systemic shocks to relationships. So you can have, I don't want to say the whole economy, but if you have a complex supply network for something like biomedical devices or something that looks like this, in a way that I'll make more precise, then small shocks or moderate shocks can have really, really big effects on what the system is capable of doing. And so what that looks like empirically is that many supply chains, maybe for totally unrelated things, are going to simultaneously and sort of severely freeze up. And that's not just a possibility. When we come to the endogenous network or endogenous investment analysis, we'll find that there's something natural about the system that draws the outcome to that kind of fragile regime. And so those are the two. In many ways, the model I'm going to tell you about is not nearly as sophisticated and deep in the macro sense as what we've been seeing, but we think this thing that we'll call a precipice, this freezing, is a sort of strong force, and I want to exposit it to you in the simplest way I can, trusting that then you'll be able to make it better in all the ways that we haven't succeeded in. So a tiny bit more about context. I'm going to be quick here, but a story about the COVID shock is that the COVID shock shifted demand from services to goods, and that stressed the whole world shipping and logistics network. And so then, all the industries, all the firms in the world that used that network were effectively shocked by that. That stress affected them, even if they weren't much affected by the initial shock that brought this situation about. So it's not, by the way, it's not that supply chains were doing worse in some sense in 2021. They were actually putting through more goods than they usually do, but the stress made for congestion and queues and delays, and that affects everyone who uses them, right? And so in terms of people experiencing shortages and delays, that certainly got worse. Now thinking about that in detail, and here I'm just continuing very much in the theme that David and Alireza established, we're gonna have to think seriously about firm-to-firm relationships. And so that's a fairly recent thing in the production networks literature, very much thanks to the work of David and Emmanuel. There are now models. There weren't, initially first generation production networks was mostly about industry to industry relationships, but now we care a lot about firms more recently. But macroeconomists typically take a sort of smooth view that's not going to have the main thing that I care about, which is disruptions that are really a big deal for an individual firm, disruptions that discreetly or severely damage a given firm's ability to do its thing. And it might not be big in the aggregate, but they're certainly big to that firm. And so we're going to tie into work on relational contracts and the importance of, carefully built commercial relationships between firms that I'll talk more about this literature later. At a sort of technical or methodological level, we're going to take production networks and bring to them a certain thing that's a very big thing in network theory, which is the analysis of what's called percolation. Take a network, disable some of it, drop out some of the links or nodes, and see what happens to some aggregate outcome, like its functionality or connectivity.
I was wondering, it's a general remark, not just for this paper. To which extent the shape of a network affects the propensity of an economy to be inflationary? Is that something that people are looking at?
That's a great point. Okay,
is
so,
that
yes.
Very interesting to see how some countries we see go more into spirals than others, but is it? It has to do with the wage bargaining and things, but it may have to do also with the shape of the network.
Good. So, first questions throughout, and I think that's a very so my. I'm very interested in that. I'm going to show you an effect that in some sense produces an aggregate, something that looks inelastic from the shape of the network. And then how to think about inflation in that is way above my pay grade, but I hope that the hope is exactly what you said, that seeing that picture, that'll be useful for the kind of thing you want to ask. I'll say a little more about especially how this ties into relational contracts, but I want to show you enough about the model so that we can have that conversation. So let me start telling you about a piece of the model first, and this will be the perspective of a single firm. So remember, so in this economy, there's going to be small firms that have supply relationships whereby they source from other small firms. And a typical firm needs to procure several different inputs to produce. And so it has multiple potential sources of each input, each of which is going to work with a probability, and this is a huge simplification, it doesn't matter much, but we're going to just take one probability that links work in the economy. At first it's going to be exogenous, later it's going to be endogenous. So each of these links works independently with probability X. So you see like this in our little example, this airplane manufacturer relies on brakes and computers, and it's really hoping that at least one computer sourcing link and at least one brake sourcing link works. And its suppliers are in the same sort of situation, but one step less deep. And eventually you get to a point that's so upstream that these guys don't rely on any specific sourcing. You can think that they buy commodity inputs, they just get them generics on some market. And so the key outcome I'm going to be interested in, and I can introduce it already in this toy example, is what I call reliability. So reliability for this tree is going to be the probability that the most downstream firm here can produce. So it's going to depend on X, which is the probability that each link is functional, and it's going to be dependent on depth, depth is 2 here. I'll explain that later. But let me talk you through what reliability is about. So first, the very first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to do the percolation. I'm going to turn these dotted links into some links work and some links don't. Now, so with probability X, some of these links kind of became alive and now they're capable of delivering. Now let's see whether A1 can produce and let's solve for that backwards. So looking at B2, so look at this brake manufacturer. It happens that for one of the critical inputs, so everybody here has 2 inputs that they need, it needs this input. Unfortunately, neither link for sourcing that input works. And so I've turned this guy pink to indicate that there's no way this brake manufacturer can make the brakes. And now that's a real problem for our hero here, A1, because, so this brake manufacturer, it actually is operating, but unfortunately there's no working link. That shipping, that's not gonna get there in time. And this shipping link would actually work, but unfortunately there's nothing to send because this guy's not working. So A1 is not going to be able to produce in this period, okay, whatever you want to call the time scale of this. And so we took a realization and then we figured out that A1 is not working. Of course, we could keep drawing these different percolation realizations and we could compute the probability, the fraction of the time that A1 is going to be functional. And of course, the probability calculation is going to depend on depth. Here, depth was 2. If we had to go more steps, it would be a different number. And so we're going to be interested in, well, first we're going to be interested in more than one tree. We're going to put together a bunch of these in a whole big network, and I'll tell you about how we do that. And then we're going to be interested in how this rho depends on X, on the shock probability. And yes, okay.
You said that is 2, but I don't know, is it the amount of inputs you need or how many layers there are?
It's how many layers there are, and I'll talk about the amount and the quantity stuff when I tell you about the production on it.
I was wondering whether X would depend on the tree itself, because you might want to write contracts saying you must have spare capacity for me in state contingent way.
Very good. So when we invest in X and X becomes endogenous, it'll be an important question of how that would depend on depth, whether you can do a sort of targeted investment in the terminology that David used. And so I'll come back to that, but in the endogenous part. Okay, so let me start. So I have now comes this. So I've told you, hopefully you have some idea of sort of how the key, this is really this thing in a sort of theory talk. I would just talk about mostly this, but I do need to put this in a bigger economy so I can talk about aggregates. So I have 2 slides where I tell you how I take this key building block and put it into a bigger economy where there's going to be lots of these things producing everything. So I'll tell you the key sort of moving parts in the model. We're going to have a finite set of products, airplanes, brakes, computers, and so on. Those are those are product types. Within each of those, there's going to be a continuum of variety. So there's going to be a continuum of small firms for every one of these I's, for airplanes, for example, specialized firms producing differentiated varieties of that thing. And this isn't, okay, this notation isn't that important, but I've been writing like A.1, the firm indices are real numbers in an interval. So I'm going to index these firms by, some interval of real numbers. Now, each of these, when I tell you it's an airplane, that determines a certain set of required inputs. So the airplane requires a set of essential inputs, in my toy example, brakes and computers, which are what goes into its Cobb-Douglas production function. So if you get no brakes or no computers, you make no airplanes. But there can be substitution between them in the production function. And now one thing, so we've been looking at depths. So each variety is going to have a depth, which is a non-negative integer, which tells you the number of steps of specific sourcing required to produce that thing. So that's the depth of a variety. And we're, as I kind of anticipated, I'm not going to be interested in just one tree. We're going to be looking at a whole network with a distribution of depths. And so there's going to be some distribution mu over non-negative integers, saying how many trees are there of depth 4, 7, 18, and so forth. They're going to be somehow connected together, as I'll tell you in a moment. But you can just, if you want a concrete example, and in some of the pictures I'll show you, we say something like, let the distribution of depth be Poisson with mean 12. Okay, and you could, in principle, look in the data for how deep stuff actually is. All right, so that's the sort of notation. And now I'm going to tell you about production, and then I can tell you the first main result. Okay, so there's going to be a thing called the potential supply network, which is the dotted lines. We're going to have a graph now, a big network, on the set of all firms. The nodes here are all this continuum of small firms that I've told you about. And they have directed links among them, capturing potential sourcing relationships. So I'm going to tell you about the distribution of this graph, this random network. And throughout the talk, I'm going to focus on a highly symmetric case. So I'm going to make everything look very much the same throughout the economy, which is going to let me draw really simple pictures. And I'll tell you on the last slide that I don't need that symmetry, but it sure will help for exposition. So the symmetric case is, you'll see now what I'm doing. If you take a variety, which is a product type and a firm producing it, which is also the variety index, there's a certain depth that it has, a number of levels of specific sourcing. And let's assume that each firm needs m distinct inputs. So everybody has a Cobb-Douglas production function with m distinct things that it puts together. That's going to be symmetric throughout the economy. And if you're a guy of positive depth, meaning that you don't just source generics, you need to get you will get a certain number, n, of potential suppliers of the compatible depth. So if I'm a depth 7 guy, I'm going to get depth 6 suppliers for each of my requisites. So that airplane guy got brake suppliers of depth 1, right? And they're going to draw the same number. So the symmetry is that this m, how many inputs you need and how many options you have for each input, those are numbers that are just fixed numbers throughout the entire economy. And I don't really care how they match. They're just going to atomlessly extend these links to find to the continuum of people who can give them the things they need. And so we're going to basically create these trees I showed you by matching people in this big continuum, matching them together. And yes, go ahead.
Can you explain why you need symmetry?
I don't need it, but I'm going to be showing you outcomes of reliability as one number for the economy, so I want to have one fixed point equation. If I had more, I'd have to think of a whole system. And so, Fred. Now, the depth zero guys, they need no specific sourcing. They can buy generics, so they'll always be productive. And so, once I realize this supply, once I have a potential supply network, the dotted lines, I'm going to define the realized supply network as the subnetwork where only the links that are kept are the ones that were randomly selected to work, a fraction x of them. And only the operational links can be used for sourcing inputs. Okay, so that's now I built up from this one example tree to a whole continuum of trees interacting together. And the only other thing I'll need to tell you now is what actually happens economically on this network. But this is the main object of study, and I'm now going to define a production process on top of it so that there's something that we economically care about. So in terms of what happens on the network, once we have the realized graph, the percolated one with only the functional links, it's going to be very simple. Each firm is going to have a Cobb-Douglas production function where it can use only the input varieties the only input varieties it could in principle use in its factory are the ones, the dotted lines, and then the only ones it can actually get a hold of are the solid lines that were realized as working. So it can source outputs along any operational link. Now, to Yvonne's question, there's no capacity constraint along working links. So I certainly can make my thing if I lack any links to one of my necessary inputs, but once I have at least one, we're going to be able to buy as much as we need. And the way production is going to use, in addition to these inputs, it's going to use labor, which is the sole factor, which is what closes the economy. It's in fixed total supply, so there's going to be a labor that we use to make all these varieties. Go ahead, Gita.
Can these firms hold inventories?
Very good. So the short answer is no. When I make x and dot, you can think of x as in some sense a proxy for inventories, because as x gets higher, it means that for the same shock, I might be able to effectively have it. But I'm not modeling inventories explicitly. Yeah, I could imagine. I don't see a fundamental.
It's not
Yeah, it's an interesting. I mean, I want. So let's hold that. I'll when we move to the endogenizing things, I'll try to convince you that the sorts of things that make you think about inventories, I'm going to try to put in the model. And
yes, and I had another question about capacity constraints. Can you add some?
Good. So it's actually you could add them. It would complicate. It's kind of going to be important to make the simple probabilistic calculations. It really helps that I care about do you have a link or don't. But in principle, you could put quantities in, and it would be. You're going to somehow allocate, like you have this big network, some of it works, you're going to put labor through it, you're going to make some things, and then in terms of consumption, there's the end of the economic model, there's a consumer who has a love of variety utility function and likes to eat what these firms produce, and I'm going to just assume that each firm, in addition to making intermediates, contributes a final variety so that each of these firms is directly useful. So all of the goods in this economy are also edible as final goods, and the consumer has a CES utility function. The household loves variety, so the more goods that can be produced, the better. That's going to be. And of course, you don't need that symmetry. You could just have some of the goods be. The basic idea is the more varieties can operate in the economy, the more different kind of stuff you're going to make. And so if you put a love of variety force in, that's going to be good. So, yes? Oh, yeah, one could do. I mean, all I care, what's going to be important, I just want a way to make reliability, the fraction of functioning firms, matter. And so I do it in the CES way. Okay, so now I can get to telling you the main thing that I have to tell you. So that what I'm going to be interested in is the share of functioning firms, which is the reliability of the supply network. And you could determine this even in the continuum. You could do a very similar exercise to the one I showed you before, where inductively, starting from the depth zero firms, you can iterate. So depth zero firms are always going to be working. Then you can ask how many depth one firms are going to happen to have enough links to depth zero firms to work, and then inductively calculate all the reliabilities. And ultimately, then we have to average, because the depth distribution is some distribution we're given, but we can figure out the fraction of firms in the economy that are capable of producing. And why does this matter? Well, for the reasons I just told you, when production occurs in the realized supply network, it'll be that equilibrium welfare is a nice smooth increasing function of rho. That's all you really need. So any model that you bring that gives you that, where more varieties functioning is good, you'll care about the same thing I care about, which is how high can rho be. And now I want to tell you what I think is a surprising. So more varieties functioning is a happier consumer. And now I want to tell you the main thing I want to tell you about how rho looks. Okay, so this is now, I can show you my favorite, first exposure to my favorite picture, which is this. So what I've plotted here is on the x-axis, I've plotted relationship strength throughout the economy. For now, exogenous x. So there's one x throughout the whole economy. And I'm going to increase it, and I'm going to look at the reliability, the fraction of firms functioning. Here I've taken a particular distribution of depths, which is Poisson with average 12, I think. And so what you see in the picture is that for low x, when strength is low, you very few varieties can do anything. Then suddenly, when x crosses some critical level, you suddenly get up to a lot of production. And if I took depth and made it bigger, if I ran average depth, if I made the typical variety require more steps of specialized sourcing, this picture would converge to this picture, which has a genuine vertical bit, which we call a precipice. So the punchline here is that when supply networks are deep and complex, and I'll explain what that means, there are precipices where if we happen to be like over here, a small and systemic shock to X can cost you a lot of production in terms of the variety you're able to sustain. So the economy is, in this sense, very fragile to an aggregate shock in X. And it didn't really matter, it doesn't matter for that punchline that X is homogeneous throughout the economy. What matters is that it's homogeneously shocked. So if I had a lot of different X's running around, but I reduced them all by epsilon, I would get the same kind of picture. And so, I guess, let me just say it mathematically. So the key bit I want to say mathematically is this really relies on M at least 2. What is M? M was the number of distinct inputs you were sourcing in addition to labor in your production, the number of these fragile things. And so if in that world X is below some critical X, then as the depth distribution converges in probability to infinity, as the typical variety gets deep, then you'll have no reliability in the limit. And if x is above the critical level, this is also interesting, there will be here an r crit, which is above a half in this example, so that even though you need, you know, a million steps of specialized sourcing, you can still do it, because this branching, this multi-sourcing, you know, gives you enough, the at each stage there's enough survival of the sourcing possibilities that you can manage to keep going. And so and this force, I want to say, critically relies on complexity m equals 2. If we had m equals 1, which means that in addition to labor you're only sourcing one disruptible input, one input from another firm, then you would have this picture, which is very different. You would have a continuous decrease in reliability as x decreases. There would be a kink, but the derivative is bounded everywhere. It doesn't look like this. And so I'm going to, you know, this for now, this is
how
just...
How do you find, maybe you talk about that later, the relationships, trying how you capture it empirically? What kind of...
Very good. Next slide. Very next slide. Slide. Thank you.
I'm curious.
Yeah. Me too. Complexity means two things. Throughout, I'm kind of holding fixed that there are many layers. That's one mode of complexity. But m equals 1 versus 2 turns out to be another important kind of complexity that really determines which of these we see. Okay, so now to how to think about this x business, especially somewhat empirically. And this is actually, I didn't know anything about this, and I recently had a conversation with Emi Nakamura, who taught me about literature that I find now very exciting. So one way to think about x is that they capture the delivery lags. So in a series of papers in the 70s and 80s, Carlton argued that the price mechanism was a lot less important than he thought in mediating sort of the year-level interaction between firms and their suppliers. And quantity rationing that was managed in a quite sophisticated way was actually kind of a big deal. And he documents a lot of that in firm panel data. So we take a world where delivery failures are a fact of life. They happen normally, you know, and firms negotiate about delays and rationing. And what we care about is, what if there's now an aggregate shock that affects everybody's lag distribution, right? And so it does require an important implicit assumption. I hope it's been clear, but we take the view that in the short run, on the time scale of this shock, prices are not going to solve this problem. You know, you can't just pay more.
And I was asking the question because I wanted to know to which extent the X was itself endogenous to the network.
Perfect.
The fact that you are, that's why I was asking.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you can
absolutely. Was you're looking at an equilibrium, at an endogenous variable, which itself.
Yeah, yeah. So for now, X has been exogenous. And the second half of the talk is exactly. Okay. Now that we take, now given this, so Carlton's view was not that delivery lags are a fact of life and there's just random bad stuff that nobody can do anything about. He believed firms really worry about them, and in particular nurture their relational contracts to manage these non-price mediators of their deliveries. And so there's a big literature both in economics and in kind of market, in the sociology of markets, where people have documented in particular markets that firms invest a lot in managing and investing in their relationships with suppliers to make them more likely to work when they're needed. And so we're going to take that seriously in the rest of the talk. Yeah. Yes, okay, and but
I then you want to shock it, that's right. So if you wanted to identify, you know, to do a kind of empirical exercise, what would be a shock to the way costs operate? If you want to say, you know, suddenly there is a change in X, what would it be?
Well, so first of all, good. So what is a change?
Otherwise, you do, you know.
Good. So two. I would push back very gently on the idea that this is distinctive to somehow undeveloped economies, because I think there's a lot, it's true that contracting possibilities expand, but in more sophisticated economies, the stuff you do is more sophisticated too, and so it's not clear what, you know, so I think many people, certainly in this literature, many people believe relational contracts are essential, even for firms like Apple, you know, and of course contracting helps, it's a complement to all this. In terms of what the shock is and how to think about that, when I present the endogenous model, I'll tell you exactly how I want to model the shock to the contracts. Okay? So now I can tell you, you know, on the bright side, This endogenous part of the model is much simpler to describe, so I'm going to be able to do everything, both the model and almost the result on this slide, and this is the last result I want to present. So we're now going to let each firm choose the strength of its links, which means invest in its relational contracting capability or its relational contract quality. So before the network is realized, each firm is going to choose XIF. IF is the little firm. It's going to choose its own XIF, which means its links are going to work with probability XIF. Now, of course, this is not free. You're going to pay a cost to invest in your links and make them work, where you have a nice standard cost function, which has an ANOTA condition. So you can even make your links work with probability 1 or nearly 1 if you want, but it's going to cost you a lot. It's going to cost hiring a lot of lawyers and good managers, you know, lawyers to write contracts.
I was thinking the extra span of control. For example, I have a commitment vis-a-vis many other firms. I'm less likely to honor my commitment towards you. But
perfect.
That depends on the network.
Perfect. So good. But I want to say two things. It is important in my model that this investment happens in kind of a non-cooperative Nash equilibrium. So to the extent that you want to consider like Japan style, you know, you want to consider these broad-reaching almost firms that effectively set X collectively. That's exactly, I mean, I'm very interested in that, and this model is going to show that that's a great idea, but to the extent that you don't have that and you have to do this across boundaries, we're going to assume you can't contractually commit to take your supplier to dinner twice a term and, you know, and buy them gifts and make them care about you. That's exactly the kind of stuff you can contract on, so you have to model it as like a decentralized investment in a game. Exactly. That's going to be the main result. It's going to be the... Now I've told you about the cost. So this cost is paid up front. I'm going to tell you about the benefit. When a firm produces, it's very simple. It's going to earn a gross profit. Gross profit is that formula, and I'll unpack that formula. So rho I is the reliability of your competitors, people making the same thing. And I'm going to make an assumption, which I think it comes out if you take the model I showed you before and you put the simplest monopolistic competition market structure on it, it's going to be that this is decreasing in the competitors to you. So when more people are making the same thing you're making, you're going to take a smaller share of the market and your gross profits are going to be smaller. So it's decreasing in your competitors' reliability. You like being active more, you like being productive more when your competitors are not. And there's going to be a shifter kappa here, which just scales the productivity of the whole economy, which is what I'm going to use to examine how much can the economy produce in equilibrium. So I'm going to be, my main comparative statics are going to be varying kappa. And so now I can show you, so here let me ask you a naive question first. This is the R crit, the very reliability at the very top of the precipice in the previous picture. And so let's think that a planner, so this is actually related to these questions of joint choice, kind of efficient choice of this, if a planner were setting all of our investments with the same technology that's on the left of the slide, would the supply network ever be at a place like that I've marked there? And the answer is, of course not, because there, if the planner could just ask everyone to make a tiny improvement in all of their X's together, you would move way up this reliability, you know, curve, and therefore the consumer would get much more welfare, but it would cost you by, you know, whatever marginal cost it was there, which is not going to be infinite, and so that would not be a good place to be. You would always invest away from that. And so there are sort of two strikes against being anywhere on this precipice. First, if you're just thinking of choosing X kind of randomly, you would never randomly happen to be, you know, pick the X that puts you right there. And also, efficiently, there's no reason to be there. But I'm going to tell you, and this is the last thing I'll tell you, that it can happen in equilibrium. It can happen when these firms decentralized invest in X. Thank you. I guess just to be totally specific, we're going to say that an outcome X is a symmetric undominated equilibrium of this model. If each firm is optimizing, so for the given, you know, given the gross profit functions that are there, and given that everybody else is investing X, we're going to assume that each firm is best off choosing the very same level of X. So like if, you know, your profit is, if you function, you get the gross profit. And the probability that you function depends on how much your suppliers are investing. It depends on how reliable they are. How much profit you make depends on how reliable they are. So that's all endogenous. And you pay this cost up front. So if everybody's maximizing, that's an equilibrium. You'll see there can be multiple equilibria, and we're going to choose the efficient one. So we're going to make the efficient selection just so we're not driven by coordination. very much like Ali Reza, we're not going to be driven by coordination failures. We're going to look at the, what did you call it? It's like the good, like the fundamental, we're going to look for fundamental fragility, not miscoordination fragility. So now I can tell you the result. So for any, fix a kappa, fix a productivity of the economy. You've seen this curve. I can add to it this other curve, which is the best response curve. How should you think about this? Imagine all of your suppliers and your competitors too are choosing an X that makes them reliable at this level. What would you want to invest in best response to that? You have an investment problem, so you can, if they were reliable, 50%, 15% of the time, what would you invest in best response? That's going to give you an X. And here we observe there's no, for all of the best response investments that are possible, none of them actually results in enough strength to sustain any production. But as we start moving kappa up, eventually we're going to touch the physical, kind of the mechanical production curve. And we're going to have all of these, so we're actually focused, we're going to focus on this top intersection, that's the efficient equilibrium. And we see that that equilibrium intersects this line and for quite a while stays on the vertical part, at some point it reaches the top. And so this is the main theorem. When supply networks are sufficiently deep, which gets you this vertical bit and everything, there's going to be an interval of kappas, of productivities, such that for kappas in that interval, the undominated equilibrium is arbitrarily close to the precipice. So you'll actually be on the precipice where a planner would never choose to be. For lower kappa, we saw equilibrium is unproductive. For higher kappa, equilibrium is above the precipice. So in this critical range, you're there on the precipice. Why is that a bad thing? Because of this corollary. So now, we imagine aggregate shocks. We have an investment technology for before the fact, writing contracts, having dinner, creating our X's. But then a shock comes and makes our X's a little lower than we hoped. And it can be, for simplicity, we can make it an MIT shock, but it can also be anticipated. And there, so we've invested, we've hit this X, and now unfortunately, we all get a little bit lower X. And what is that gonna do? That's gonna make our equilibrium production in those states of the world, the shock states of the world, we're gonna collapse. And so it's gonna be, and that's gonna happen for economies of intermediate productivity, okay? I'm out of time, so I'm gonna just put up the conclusion slide. How many minutes exactly do you think I have?
Two minutes.
2 minutes, okay. So the fundamental friction in this model is that investments in relationship strength are not contractible. If they were fully contractible, then the second part of the talk wouldn't apply. You would have some contracting game which among all the firms. We think that in reality, reputation for reliability can substitute for contracting, but reputational games of that kind come with frictions of their own. We've done a lot of, so the homogeneity, the symmetry I've assumed doesn't matter. You can do all of this with much more heterogeneous models. The last thing I'll say is that it's not so easy to fix this problem. If you subsidize relationship and investment strength, equilibrium incentives are going to crowd it out one for one, and you're going to stay fragile. You need big investments for reasons distinct from traditional big push theory to get out of this kind of problem. And in the paper, we talk about targeting robustness policy issues of reshoring, lots of applications. But I'm the only thing standing between you and lunch. Very grateful for your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.